This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak radio show. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS radio every Tuesday night and Wednesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, or by going to our site at www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to past shows on our iPod Ready archive section. That's www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. You can now also listen live via satellite on your Nokia phones. Just go to the website for the details. It's our pleasure to have our guest tonight with us, Alvin Toffler, renowned author and known around the world for the work that has influenced presidents, prime ministers, top leaders in fields ranging from business to nonprofit organizations, as well as educators, psychologists, and social scientists. He is the author of Third Wave, Future Shock, and Power Shift, and tonight we are going to be discussing his newest book, Revolutionary Wealth. The book attacks key issues of conventional economics as it paints an emerging global wealth system of the decades ahead. The Tofflers decades ago anticipated things such as cloning, virtual reality, niche markets, information overload, work at home, product customization, the demassification of the mass media, and the threat of terrorism, and many other features of our contemporary life today. But the Tofflers' work for these forecasts were all mere details to a far larger canvas. What differentiates the Tofflers from others who today echo this view is their insistence that there can be no economic transformation without a corresponding upheaval in our social, political, and cultural institutions and values. Hello, Mr. Tofflers. How are you? Very very nice having you with us this evening.
A pleasure.
Alvin, can you define what a knowledge-based society is for our listeners?
Well, in the most simple form, we know from what little history we actually study that our ancient ancestors were almost all peasants, living by agriculture and living short lives. That was followed by the Industrial Revolution, starting, say, 350 or thereabouts years ago, maybe 400 or 200, whatever. And you see around the world countries making that transition now, going from a peasant economy, as in China, more and more into an urban, industrialized economy. And that is the British model. It's what experts and economists told poor people around the world, that if you want to escape poverty, you've got to become an industrial economy, an urban industrial economy. And the experts on development theory and so forth all said that to them. However, they paid relatively little, if almost no attention, to the fact that there is now a third stage of development, if you want to call it that, or the arrival of a third new form of economic and social and cultural life, and that is based on knowledge. And that knocks the props out from under a great deal of conventional economics. And so our new book called Revolutionary Wealth, which has been published in many countries already recently, deals with this and argues that you cannot understand the economy without paying attention to what the knowledge element does to it. It no longer operates the way the classical books of economics taught us.
Thank you. Your books also show people how the changing world's economies and how this information that we gather can affect us. You coined a word that I found to be quite fascinating, Alvin, in your, I believe it's pronounced ocellage.
Ocellage.
Ocellage. Okay. Ocellage. And in this, you say that, this is two, basically two words come together, obsolete knowledge.
Right.
Now,
right.
What do you mean by obsolete knowledge?
Well, we all have information packed away in our skulls someplace, or in books, indeed, like our own. And they picture a world, or they picture an environment, or a reality in which we live. But in the past, they were pretty good, very, very valuable to have that knowledge. And we would put it in our brains. We would study, learn, whatever, or learn from experience. However, we live now in economies and societies, not all of them, but in our own, in the U.S. certainly, that are changing at so rapid a pace that what we knew last year becomes frequently obsolete this year. Just as products become obsolete, and technologies become obsolete, so too the ideas and assumptions that we have in our brains and carry around with us. And so we argue that many of the decisions that are made, whether in corporate, military, political, and also in personal life, are based on facts that are no longer real, that are based on assumptions that are now no longer relevant because the world has changed out from under us, changed rapidly, and is continuing to accelerate. And therefore, no matter what, some part of what we think we know or what we are frequently sure that we know is in fact obsolete by the time we've learned it.
Which is interesting because if you're defining what our future economic base is as a knowledge-based society, how is here the very knowledge that you're speaking of and referring to is sometimes obsolete before we've even accessed it or had it presented to us in a format that's useful to us at the common man's mm-hmm. level, the working man's level.
Mm-hmm.
How is that different from the past forms of societal economies, and what kind of an impact is that going to have on the economy today?
Well, it's part of acceleration, and acceleration is one of what we call the deep fundamentals of economics. One of the things we do in Revolutionary Wealth is argue that, as I said earlier, that what you learned about an industrial economy does not necessarily apply to a knowledge-based economy. Economists were frequently taught that economics itself has to do with the use of resources, what we now discover is that one of the most critical of all the resources is in fact knowledge. And the difference between knowledge and all the other resources that economists studied and wrote about is that it behaves in a radically different way than any of the other resources. For example, economics is often described as a science of the allocation of scarce resources. Well, we certainly know about scarce resources, like oil, but knowledge is not scarce. And not only that, it's not that it's inherently scarce. It's that you can, if you use a scarce resource, if you use the oil, I can't. If you use your assembly line, I can't use your assembly line at the same time. If you grow rice in your rice paddy, I can't grow rice in the same rice paddy at the same time. But if we have knowledge, we can have the same knowledge, we can share the knowledge, we can use it at the same time, and not only that, we make more. We don't use it up. We don't use up arithmetic because we all know arithmetic. In fact, what happens is the more people use the knowledge, the more the likelihood of creating new and better knowledge exists. And that is so different from the underlying, one of the absolutely underlying premises of traditional economics, that most economists have not yet been able to figure out what to do with this new reality.
Well, if knowledge is the new source of resource for the economic growth of the future, and if that knowledge is considered an expandable commodity with no limits, then it stands to reason that wealth in today's day and age quite possibly has no limits either.
Well, that may very well be true if we extend our, you know, our future horizon into science fiction times, but that's not crazy. I want to add something to the description of knowledge. It's not just that knowledge is something we can both use without using it up. It has other characteristics that are so radically different from the traditional resources that we frequently battle over and even sometimes go to war over. First of all, of course, it's intangible. You can't touch it. Secondly, it's nonlinear. That means that a small increase in our knowledge about X can result in huge consequences, big impacts. It's also what we call relational. That is, it only has meaning in relationship to other bits and pieces and parts of knowledge. So they come together. They have to be interrelated. And they're compressible. Knowledge is compressible into tiny symbols and abstractions. And it can be take the form of implicit or explicit or tacit. And not only that, you can't bottle it up forever. So this is a radically different component of economics. Now, people always depended on knowledge to some degree. I mean, even hunters and gatherers had to have some understanding of when the animal was going to come to the water hole so they could kill it and eat it. But no previous time in history, in no previous time in history, have we been as dependent on a huge bank, so to speak, of knowledge. But the money in that bank, the ideas and the concepts and the assumptions and all the rest of that, are, as I said, changing very more rapidly than any previous time in history. So it makes this moment a different one in history, that you can't just look at, well, yet it's just an extension of industrialization or an extension of any traditional economy. And we haven't figured out yet how to live with this reality. The economists don't know, but it's not just the economists who don't know. We have education systems that haven't figured out how to deal with this. We have government political decisions that are being made based on increasingly obsolete information. And in the U.S., we, as probably most of the world knows, we're preparing for an election. And we've had this very exciting conflict between people who want to be president of the United States. And we started with long lists, you know, a half a dozen or a dozen candidates here and 8 or 10 over there. And not one, with one minor exception, has ever said to the American people, look, folks, we're going through what is nothing less than a revolution. And that revolution is in economics, and all the old rules need to be reexamined and probably don't apply. And not only that, we have to invent our way, create our way, innovate our way into this new world. Instead, what we hear is, we got to get back those manufacturing jobs that have been outsourced. Well, the politicians who play that, and media people and so on, who talk about that, are, I believe, mostly ignorant of the fact that manufacturing, traditional assembly line manufacturing, which, by the way, is something that Heidi and I did each for 5 years, making automobiles and worked on that assembly line with our hands for a long time. So we know something about that. But that in the U.S., manufacturing jobs fell below the jobs in services and other sectors in 1956. That's how long there has been a decline, a relative decline, in manufacturing as related to other parts of the economy.
Well, let me quote from your own book, by the time much of the data, and this is going to take it back to Asfalaj, because I found that to be such a profound issue. By the time much of the data, information, and knowledge that public employees need to do their jobs reaches them in useful form, it has already been acted on by the private sector players. Public sector workers can't keep up. If knowledge, sir, becomes obsolete more quickly than man can acquire the ability to use it in the work arena, doesn't this eventually make mankind obsolete in the workforce? And if this is true, and this is the dark side of this, and it is a bit frightening, do we eventually become the work slaves of the future?
Well, I think that, but first of all, let me say something about everything I've said and everything I'm going to say, and that is nobody knows the future with certainty. And we don't even use the word predict because some
people
assume.
That's your official disclaimer.
Yeah, right.
You've done pretty good at predicting the future.
Yeah, if you say predict, they assume you mean it's certain. We do, you know, the chance operates in reality, and so you can never be 100% certain of the future. But you can be reasonably intelligent about things that are happening. It seems to me that if we talk about manufacturing, it doesn't mean that manufacturing stops. It means that it's transferred to other places. For example, I can easily imagine myself sitting at my computer at home and saying I've decided to buy a car which is made in some country, you know, 5,000 miles away from where I am, and that hasn't even yet been manufactured. And I punch in on my computer what I want, what are the characteristics, the functions, and so forth, and I push the button that activates an assembly line without many people on that assembly line at a remote part of the world, which then turns out the automobile, in which case I am contributing to the production. It's hard to separate me from the people who are actually at the other end of the communication. So I believe desktop manufacturing is going to be a reality for certain things, I think that we're going to re-examine what we mean by manufacturing. There is the kind of manufacturing, as I said, industrial age manufacturing, where you work on an assembly line all day long, and there's increasingly advanced manufacturing, which is knowledge dependent, more and more and more sophisticated, more and more dependent on educated, trained, skilled employees, or indeed not employees, but even individual contractors, so to speak. Maybe I don't work on that assembly line. The assembly line works very well by my pushing a button, but I work at home designing what's coming out the other end, and so forth. So I think nobody knows for sure the answers to these questions, but I think that we need to have a far more open mind to the possibilities that are created by this new system.
Well, I certainly don't think an open mind would help would hurt our economy at this point. Alvin, you write about the third job. Can you explain the third job and show how many cases we spend more time on our third job than we do our first or second?
Sure. Heidi and I write about what we call the third job. The first job is you go to an office, you go to a factory, you go to a site, or you work at home, and you get paid for it. That's a job. That's what we call a job. And usually, it has fixed hours and so on. But you also have a job at home, and that is you go shopping for food, you raise your kids, you paint the living room, you do all this stuff, you do it yourself. And what you're doing when you're doing that, well, just as when you do the first thing I described, and you work for an employer, for example, you are contributing to the gross domestic product, to what economists regard as the economy. They don't regard what you do at home for free, so to speak, as also part of the economy. But that's a job, too. And if you're a mom and you're taking care of your kid, that's a big job. As somebody did a survey, some group in New York did a survey and said, What if a woman got paid for all the things she did during child raising, what would that be? And they said, okay, the kid scratches his knee. She puts a Band-Aid on. She's being the doctor. She's the chauffeur who drives the kid to school in many cases. She's the teacher because she teaches him some language or corrects some mistake and so forth and so on. And they calculated all the different, so they laid out all the different functions of a mom. And then said, what would it cost if they hired somebody to do, hired different people to do each of those different functions? And that came from that, they calculated that the mom's work is worth, at least in New York, $134,000 a year.
At least.
But that's not work you get paid for. Right? So all of us are performing certain things that are outside the part of the wealth system that economists pay attention to. And we also know, it's not just moms. How many of the folks who may be listening to this or reading to this use an ATM machine? Well, what do you do when you go to the ATM machine? You punch in some data. But it used to be, before the ATMs were available, you went to a bank, you stood at the counter. Behind the counter, there was an employee. Usually a woman, but frequently, either way, and you gave the information to the teller behind the counter, and he or she would then enter that into some, probably usually by handwriting, into some book, and then they gave you the amount of money you were cashing a check or you were doing this or the other transaction. The fact of the matter is, you now enter that information into the machine yourself. And the consequence of that in the United States, if you calculate how much time was spent in these transactions, you can run up something like 200,000 jobs for tellers are eliminated by the existence of that ATM machine, but only because you are inputting the information that that person behind the counter used to input. Now, this doesn't say we don't want ATMs. ATMs are very good. They're very useful. But we need to understand that there is a knowledge transaction that has been transferred, a work transaction that's been transferred to somebody who gets paid and therefore gets counted in the economy to somebody who does this without getting directly paid and that is not regarded as part of the economy. The same data entered into two different ways are treated differently.
Well, so here you've explained to us the relationship between people and machines. And in fact, in most cases, as we have seen historically, right up through the Industrial Revolution, now even further, is artificial intelligence really going to be the fourth wave of the future?
Well, I'm being an American, I come with chemical optimism. And I therefore like to believe that there'll be a fourth wave and a fifth wave and who knows how many future waves. And again, I don't know exactly. But clearly, there has been a fundamental upheaval in the role of the kind of knowledge that human beings need and develop to operate in an advanced economy and society. A tremendous upheaval since the beginnings of the... since the arrival of the computer, if you want to put it that way. Only that arrival of the computer began a lot earlier than most people think. I don't know what a survey of the audience might come up with, what year, but certainly most of the people we write for and most of the people we talk with are surprised to learn how early, how long ago it is that the first kind of inklings of the Internet arrived. And that answer goes back to the 1950s, and certainly by the 60s. Nobody anticipated adequately what an immense change this would bring to the society, not just in terms of economics, but also in lifestyle and culture and art and every other aspect of life.
How much more manipulated are we today via the advancements of computer technology than we were, say, 20 years ago?
Oh, I think we're manipulated differently. Let's put it this way. If you go back decades, you had the mass society, mass production, the key to industrialism. Mass production was accompanied by mass media, mass entertainment, mass education, mass this and mass that. And the consequence of that was, in fact, to shape a massified, more or less uniform people. And so you had less individual diversity. There were great sociological studies made of, quote, mass man, not to mention mass woman. What you saw were tremendous pressures in the institutions of the industrial age to massify people. And what has happened with the arrival of what we call the third wave of change, the agrarian revolution being the first, and industrialism being the second, and the knowledge revolution now being the third wave of change, that the consequences are just enormous. And I think that we are just beginning to see the potentials of what this is all about, and that some of these potentials are going to be horrifying, and others are going to be magnificent. And when I say horrifying, I mean we know there are those who will use the most advanced knowledge-based technologies for criminal purposes, for illegal sexual purposes, for military purposes, justified or unjustified, for terrorist purposes, and so on. So it is not easy to say, well, this is all great stuff, or that is all evil. It's neither, or both, I should say. Just as was the case in the industrial age, you could use factories for good purposes, or you could use them for terrible purposes, and they were.
Thank you, everyone. And for those of you that have just joined us, we are speaking to famed author Alvin Toffler, author of Third Wave, Power Shift, Future Shock, and currently his latest work, Revolutionary Wealth. You can call us and ask Mr. Toffler questions one-on-one at 1-877-489-6350 internationally. And in the U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. The numbers again are 888-228-4494 in the U.S. and Canada, and internationally 877-489-6350. We're going to take a short break right now, Alvin, and we'll be back with more questions. This has just been fascinating. I've just been like itching to talk to you. Like, yes! So I'm really thrilled to have you here, and I know our guests are really very big fans of yours. You are so well-renowned. It's interesting hearing when you say to someone, I'm interviewing Alvin Toffler, and it's like, oh, my God, I read him in university. He was required reading. I did, you know, and it's like it is really just great. Thank you very much, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes, folks.
Okay.
Got questions? The library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
This is Gore Vidal. Can you name the one country on earth where the government can steal elections, strip away basic rights, spy on civilians, launch wars based on lies, and where the people do not take over the nation's capital in protest? If you said the United States, you'd be right. So let's remedy that by calling our Congress members and asking them to support the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org. www.thebookstore.org.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. The economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime, to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit SOSMorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
This land is yours. Join us on the People Speak radio show every Tuesday and Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern for an hour of live interview and audience interaction with guests from the realms of entertainment, education, activism, spirituality, politics, and literature. Get involved and make a difference for the better. That's the People Speak every Tuesday and Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Network. Maybe you're me.
Hello, everybody. This is Basma Farhad, host of the People Speak radio show. We're here tonight with our guest, Alvin Toffler, author of Third Wave, many other books, and his current work, Revolutionary Wealth, which is just a fascinating book. Alvin, you wanted to discuss some of the issues of synchronization and how it affects our economic positions today in the world. Can you please elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about time. Time in our lives and time in our societies. Because one of the things that I think insufficient attention has been directed at is the change in time and timing in our society. What we argue, and we've written about the acceleration of change ever since we wrote Future Shock back in ancient history times, 1970, change has been accelerating economically advanced countries. I don't mean necessarily culturally advanced, but in the rich, advanced economies. Time has been speeding up and speeding up and speeding up. And that is, we now hear complaints that life is compressed and we're running too hard, that we're suffering from time pressures and so forth and so on. And again, as I say, we wrote about that a long time ago. But what is now apparent is something else, that we are not only running faster, but we are increasingly out of synchronization. Let's talk about synchronization for a second. We have body organs. We have lungs, we have heart, we have this, we have that. All these parts of the human body are integrated, and they operate at certain speeds, and they have to be appropriately, those speeds have to be synchronized. Otherwise, we'd probably die. And the same may well be true of the economy. And what we have is a rapid rate of change in the United States and in numerous other countries, not yet all around the world necessarily, but in key countries that are developing advanced economies, we see this, this incredible speed-up. And what you see, though, is that the speed-up is not evenly distributed throughout the institutions in society. For example, in the U.S., let's assume that we're talking about business. Businesses have to change very rapidly. They have to change their product. They have to change frequently their location. They have to change their technologies and so forth. And the reason is, the reason they have to do that quickly is competition. If they don't do that, some competitor will, and we'll wipe them out. So they're under pressure. So let's imagine for now that we're standing at the side of a highway, and on that side, there's a policeman with a radar gun, and he's checking the speed with which different cars come down the road because he's looking to give somebody a ticket. And the first car coming down the road is the car that symbolizes business, and it's coming down the highway at 100 miles an hour. Right after that, there's another car that's speeding, not quite as fast, but very fast indeed anyway, going about 90 miles an hour, and that car symbolizes the rate of growth and change of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, of civil society, which is changing at an extremely rapid pace today, spreading rapidly and interlacing with each other, groups interlacing with each other and developing very, very quickly. So you see business moving rapidly. You see NGOs moving almost as rapidly. If you then look at other institutions in the society, look at trade unions in the United States or in other countries where you're moving toward what we call a third wave or advanced knowledge-based economy, you see them making very, very slow changes to adapt to this. And I can tell you from personal experience, Heidi and I used to be, Heidi was a UAW shop steward on the assembly line. She worked, was a minor officer within a union. And we were very much pro-union. And we have tried to talk to the unions over the years, say, hey, fellas, this thing is a big revolution and it's going to hit you and it's going to bring changes and you're going to have to operate differently. And all you would get would be a blind look. We could never get anybody to take, in the labor movement, to take any of this seriously. As a result, in the U.S., the percentage of workers in unions has plummeted and is continuing to plummet. So let's say the car representing unions on the highway that the cop is monitoring, instead of going at 100 miles an hour like business or 90 miles an hour like the NGOs, is if lucky, we're doing 30 miles an hour. And then you look at government bureaucracies. How fast do they operate? My goodness. Many companies refuse to do business with Uncle Sam in the United States because it's too slow in response. The company is under pressure to make quick decisions, and the government bureaucracy ships the decision from point to point to point to point. To get up to the top level of a department, it may have to go through 50 steps. So governments in general, not just the U.S., governments are slow. So let's say we've got business going at 100 miles an hour, NGOs at 90, unions at 30. Governments are, if we're lucky, are moving at 25 miles an hour, changing their own internal structures and so on. And then you have the schools. How quickly does education change? And we are lucky if our public education system in the U.S., and I think this goes for Japan and it goes for many, many other countries, European countries as well, that the schools, education systems are lucky if they change at 10 miles an hour. And the result of all of this, and there are other things as well, at the other end of the scale, what's moving quickly? Financial interactions are moving quickly, 150 miles an hour. So what you have are different institutions in the society or different components of your society, whatever society you live in, moving at increasingly disparate or different speeds. And that creates all kinds of unnoticed economic costs and other kinds of social consequences, not to mention political consequences as well. And so you have a problem that nobody has addressed adequately, and that is this problem of getting the new emerging society appropriately synchronized to the degree that it needs to be.
Well, absolutely. Not only that, if you factor in the issue of how knowledge filters down to the worker and into the workplace, and then you couple that with this low rate of speed, to me it sounds more like a recipe for disaster. Am I wrong?
Well, what it is, I believe, is a recipe for a series of what in revolutionary wealth we call institutional Katrinas. That I believe that we're going to see breakdowns of big bureaucratic organizations in many countries, but certainly again in the U.S. that I know the best, we're going to see gigantic bureaucracies topple because they cannot keep up and they must. And as a result, when they we see disaster after disaster. I mean, the bureaucracy is the enemy of speed. And the enemy of it may integrate and synchronize inside the bureaucracy. Even that's unlikely. But as far as its relationship to the outside world, it's frightful. Take, for example, in the U.S., it's laughable. It's a joke, but it's not very funny. When after 9/11, the decision was made that our intelligence was inadequate to have anticipated and blocked this attack. And so we must change our intelligence system. So what do we do? So Uncle Sam had something on the order of 15 or 20 different bureaucracies engaged in one or another form of intelligence collection. And what we did is say we put them all together under the Department of Homeland Security, which became a mega bureaucracy. And part of it was FEMA, which is supposed to take, to be useful in times of crisis. Well, FEMA, this agency, this bureaucracy within a bureaucracy, was a disaster during the Katrina disaster that tore up all of the New Orleans.
Well, you're talking about a collapsing of some of the social institutions as well in the book. And you consider that being an inevitability, and I can see how that would work. Which ones do you think will be the collapsible institutions, and what will replace them?
Well, I wish I were creative enough to be able to invent all the alternative forms of organization. But by the way, when Heidi and I talk about bureaucracy, we're not just talking about government agencies. I mean, giant companies also are frequently huge bureaucracies as well. And that what that does is slow down response time in a society, as I said, that's increasingly demanding instantaneous response and doing that not only domestically but globally. So I don't know. I don't have the answer for all the alternative models of organization, but we do know that the pyramidal bureaucracy with the top-down command and layers and hierarchical layers within the organization was, in fact, a very efficient form of organization for an industrial smokestack society. That is what Max Weber, the great sociological writer back in times of World War I, told us. He studied that and said, no, bureaucracy is efficient. But it's not efficient for a knowledge-based, high-speed economy, which is increasingly diverse in the society, and that means we're going to see, I believe, more and more big companies and more government agencies implode, break up, because of their failure to be able to keep up with the changes in the outside world around them.
We have a couple of email questions.
Okay.
Here.
Great.
Alvin Zoli in Canada asks, and I hope I'm getting this correctly, Zoli, if you're listening, how much do you agree or disagree with those who would like to lead the world into some direction they think is on the evolution side? I'm not sure if I understand that.
I'm sure I don't. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure if evolution, maybe that was the revolution side, but we'll see if we can get some clarification through another email. From Grogan in the Canadian Rockies, Mr. Toffler, since writing Future Shock, what in your opinion is the best and worst conditions we have experienced in the progress or / regression of the human condition?
Well, I would argue that the best positive changes have been in lifespan on the planet.
Lifespan,
yeah. People are living longer, which means that that means that people around the world, for as horrible as some of the worst impoverished nations or communities are, nevertheless, on the whole, the human race is surviving better and longer. So that's clearly a positive, to me, a positive step, a highly positive step.
Well, which brings me to a question that I'm interested in. Heidi and you have worked within the health system for tragic personal reasons.
Right.
How concerned should Americans be about the crisis in the system that's going on now?
Well, the economic, the discussions about the health system that are taking place are largely aimed at the economic dimension. How much does it cost, and so forth and so on. If that were all the problem, I think we would be in very good shape. But the problem is not just money. The problem is how our structures are integrated, and the role of bureaucracy, for example, in hospitals, and the failure. We're not. I mean, here is one of the most important quote industries or quote sectors of the American economy and society, and it's not kept up with the invention of the computer, for heaven's sake. We are not adequately using the technologies available to us, and the networks available to us, in the health field. I don't leave the impression that doctors don't have computers and so forth, but there is no sensible, adequate collection of information across company lines and across hospital lines and so on, and doctors. We're not using all the information that's available for appropriate purposes.
Well, I certainly agree with you, because in my first job, I work in the medical field, and I absolutely agree with you, even though the electronic medical record systems are starting to finally emerge. We still haven't even got a condition where there are requirements in the field, and that I think. We have a caller, Mike from California on line 4. Mike, do you have a question for Alvin?
Yeah, first of all, it's a pleasure to listen to Mr. Toffler. I've read Future Shock, and
I'm
reading Revolutionary Wealth. And my question for Mr. Toffler is, you know, most people, I think, feel pretty helpless in a world of multinational corporations and big business and governments. How does understanding these things help us? I mean, what is a good practical guideline coming from you, the master, on how we, the ordinary people, can in some way influence for a better way, a better change in this world? How do we affect change?
Well, I think that, let's put it this way, I don't know the answer to that question, but I know that the old ways of approaching this are ineffectual. They were not very workable during the industrial era, and they're even less workable now, because they generally relied on what we call massification, bringing large numbers of people to march on the streets, and so forth and so on. I think that if we want to push for certain kinds of changes, that the sort of traditional protest movements don't work very well. And if they do get close to working, I'm not talking about in the United States, but try Tibet or try another country in the world, and if they do come close to working, the guns come out. So I think that we need to use the tools that we have, and the tools that we have clearly. The fact that computers are available, the fact that networks are possible, the fact that people are talking to each other outside the existing system changes dramatically the degree of power, the distribution of power, and creates tools with which to bring about change. Now, that doesn't mean that people who are in a particularly favorable position aren't going to fight to maintain their position. But I think that there are probably creative ways that we can use the new technologies to bring about significant and valuable changes in social life. And one of these, by the way, I want to go back to the failure of bureaucracies. I think what we need to do in the period ahead, both for political and for social purposes, is invent more different forms of social and economic organization. We tend to think, as I started to say before, that if you've got a problem, you create a bureaucracy. But there are many, many different ways that people can organize to bring about change, whether it is in business or whether it is political. And I think we haven't begun to see the variety of organizational structures that we will creatively create for these purposes.
Do you think any of those organizational structures exist today? And what are any of them if they do exist?
Well, there is an assumption on the part of the sort of the gurus who write about organization, frequently they're management gurus. I'm struck by the fact that there are an infinite number of ways that human beings can organize themselves for different purposes. If I'm not mistaken, and maybe somebody listening in or online can correct me on this, we're having a big election here in the United States. And we have two parties fighting each other, theoretically. But in some countries, I think it may well be Austria, maybe one of them. If Party A wins the chancellorship, Party B automatically gets the second line. And the third post goes back again to the party that won first. So we have a checkerboard kind of distribution of political power in the system. And I think that there are other places where that's not just at a national level, but occurs at city government levels and so forth. I'm not arguing that that's necessarily good or wonderful, but it's different from what Americans know. And there are many, take the military. If you looked at the People's Liberation Army of China, and if you looked at the military of the Soviet Union, when it was the Soviet Union, and quite possibly now in both countries, I don't know, you had not the way our military and most of the world's military ran, with a hierarchy of officers. You had two lines of leadership. One was military, so you had the colonel and the general and so forth and so on. But you also, in parallel with that, had another line, which was political, and the political commissar that went with each unit of the military reported back up to the political leaders, not just to the military leaders. Again, I'm hardly arguing in favor of that, but I'm saying that there are many, many different organizational structures and institutional structures that are available that human beings have used for various purposes, and that we need to devote as much talent and money and rewards to people who invent organizational structures as for those who invent physical products. And
we have another caller, but briefly, there's this question that suddenly came to me that piques my interest. You're talking about organizational structures here. One of the most prominent organizational structures that has existed in the history of mankind has always been the military. Given the circumstances today in the military and the economic instability in our country and that I believe are creating in other countries, do you see any changes that are affecting the military in this process?
I think the military, the American military, is struggling to come to understand, struggling to figure out how to use the new technologies. Whether we're talking about changing the chain of command in military life, I don't see that. Nor do I have a magic solution to how that ought to be done. But I think that what's happened is that the preparation for we're having a public debate, and the public debate says, look, the military is still fighting the Cold War, where you have a country with a national capital, and you know who the leader is, and you know where the military is, and so forth. But now we're fighting a terrorist threat, and that's quite different, where there's no big headquarters and you have tiny little non-bureaucratic flat organizational units cropping up here and dying out
exactly.
Over there. And this is not what the Western military, indeed most of world military, is accustomed to.
If Iraq is any indication, I would assume that we obviously haven't organized it as well as we had hoped to. in light of what's going on over there. We have Steve on the line from Santa Fe. Steve from Santa Fe, do you have a question for Alvin Toffler?
Well, thank you, Basma, yes. First, Mr. Toffler, thank you. I really enjoyed the discussion, and I agree with you 100%. But I do have a question. Do you think that it's possible that people with an agenda or a conspiracy can offset all of this? You know, then you were talking about Iraq. I think we can see that there were people that you know, whose agenda kind of shoved all of this aside and it became all about them. And what do you think we should do about them? Mike, excuse me. Thank you, sir.
I do not believe in conspiracy theories. That doesn't mean that you don't have groups that form up to push a particular policy or plus in favor of or opposed to. But I don't believe that the world is significantly altered today by conspiracy. I believe that at any given moment there are 10,000 or perhaps 10 million conspiracies underway, many of them canceling each other out. I think to posit this kind of solution, or that this describes what's happening, it's way, way too simple. So, as I say, I don't believe that there was a conspiracy on our side to take out 9/11, for example. I mean, to do what happened on 9/11. I don't believe... yes, could there have been a conspiracy to kill Kennedy? Yeah, but again, we certainly don't have the proof of that. And again, I think the major changes that are taking place, the important changes that are taking place, are very seldom the result of one conspiracy doing it. Again, there are, if you have conspiracy A over here, you've got another conspiracy there which is fighting it every inch of the way.
Well, you know, Alvin, this has just been amazing, and I'd like to end this note on a question for you. Hopefully this, you know, when we first started the program, we said that what differentiates you and Heidi from other writers about this is that you look at the bigger picture, that this is, let me ask you, what is the bigger picture for the next 10 years as you envision it?
Well, there's certain things that I think we already see, certain, you know, developments in science, in nanotechnologies, and more and more money going into and work being done in neuroscience, and so forth and so on. And those, I think, are going to have enormous potential impacts. Whether that will be within 10 years, I don't know. Parts of it probably will, but a lot of it won't. I think that what we're going to see is some kind of major global reshuffling of the relationships of nations to one another. And you have the nation, the notion of a nation and a state itself is coming under attack, where you have non-national groups, not just religious groups or terrorist groups, but also other kinds of organizations that are not nation-based, which are competing with nations for power on the international stage. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. So the players that are going to be operating on the global level are not just going to be the set of nation-states, and that the old foreign policy concepts of idealistic regimes versus non-idealistic, realistic regimes, or the role of multipolarity versus unipolarity. All of that stuff that we've learned about diplomacy and interaction between countries and nations, I think also are up for grabs, because the world is going to be so different that these ideas, which are very rich and richly developed, but were spawned by and for a world in which industrialism was the most advanced form of economic development, and therefore military development as well, all of these are going to be up for grabs.
Well, this is, I feel like we've just barely touched the surface of your incredible work. I want to thank you for being with us this evening, Mr. Toffler. We're going to hold Heidi, I promise, that she would come back on our show. We're going to hold her to that. We're not going to to it, but we're going to ask her to come back, too.
I'm in favor of that, and you'll get a much, much more exciting, interesting response.
Well, give her our best, and thank you again for being with us. Ladies and gentlemen, Alvin Toffler of the Third Wave fame. Get his new book, Revolutionary Wealth. I'm telling you, it's the first time I've taken out a marker to mark what I call events, and I have been marking Revolutionary Wealth all over the place. It's a great book. Please go out and get it. Thank you for being with us, everyone. Tonight, tomorrow's guest with our host, David Swanson, is Tina Meyer, mother of Megan Meyer, who committed suicide due to online harassment. On next Tuesday, March 25th, Peter Edusi G, activist and lobbyist. Thank you all for being with us tonight. It's over for the evening. Thank you very much, Mr. Toffler.
Thanks for having me. Take care. Okay. Keep
Thank you. Our pleasure. Good night, everybody. See you tomorrow night.
Good night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall by the rolling fountain, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.